This is a Digital Music Trends episode 108, recorded on the 7th of November 2012. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Digital Music Trends. After our small holiday break, we are back and forth today with two great guests. So let me start by making some introductions. So first of all, we have Gerd Lennard. He's a media futurist, keynote speaker, author, and blogger. And for those of you who haven't come across Gerd before, you should check out mediafuturist.com and see all of the work that he's done in the past. So hi Gerd, it's great to have you on. How's it going today?
Hello, greetings from Brazil.
Nice. Thanks for joining us from so far away. And then second, we have Tom Davenport, who is a freelance journalist who's writing for The Guardian, Gizmodo, CNET, amongst other publications. So hi, Tom, and how's it going today?
Hi, yeah, I'm good. Thanks for inviting me on.
That's great. Okay, so we're going to start today with one of the subjects that is probably going to take the most time, which is talking about the streaming rates and talking about the Internet Radio Fairness Act that is happening over in the States. So this is a broader subject that doesn't just involve Pandora, as some of the articles that have been published in the last few weeks have shown. It actually is a bill that has been backed by a lot of the big media, which includes, for example, Google, amongst others, and Clear Channel, for example. This act is aiming to lower the streaming rates that are going to be associated with web radio for the likes of Pandora in the States, but also something that would probably apply to Heart, which is the Clear Channel Media radio, and to any startup that would want to come into that space. The bill is called Internet Radio Fairness Act, which is a really interesting name. It doesn't include any references to money being exchanged. It doesn't include references to the fact that this is mostly a monetary problem rather than a fairness problem. the argument here is that basically the rates that are being paid by the likes of SiriusXM at the moment are so much lower than the ones that have to be paid by a purely digital streaming operation like the one Pandora has going on. And so, the act would aim to lower those rates so that everybody pays a lower fee, more similar to what SiriusXM is paying at the moment. So first of all, Gerd, what's your take on this bill? I personally think there are many sides to this argument, but to create such a drastic reduction in the income seems like a pretty bold move on the part of Pandora and all the petitioners for this reform.
Well, there's a larger problem here. First of all, everybody knows that internet radio and digital radio is essentially distribution of content. All you have to do is stream record it. Everybody knows that YouTube is essentially distributing those videos as MP3s and MP4s. It's completely easy to do, right? So we have essentially this whole diversion of saying now that Pandora isn't interactive. Clearly it kind of is. And those are all fig leaves, to me. I love Pandora. I have to say I don't have anything against, I think they should get a lower rate. But, the real problem is that A, internet radio is distribution, behind some, ignorant factor that people know about this. But the second one is that, interactivity or not interactivity, this is all just kind of meaningless now because you can just chop it up into MP3s. What really needs to happen is that we need an internet music license that creates a license for the use of music just like we have a license for radio.
Right? Yeah.
And this is the problem with Pandora. Is that Pandora is doing these things, and I think they should get a lower rate because lower rate will eventually justify the fact that streaming is the same in downloading.
Yeah.
In all reality, and the lawyers hate this idea, of course, because the copyright law says that listening is free and downloading is paid. So this is a real difficult scenario, and I think the likes of Pandora and others are suffering from this dichotomy between reality and the law, which is completely, as Michael Robertson said from MP3, former MP3.com, the word streaming is nowhere in copyright law.
Yeah.
So this is a real, real large problem.
Yeah. And Tom, what's your take on that?
You make a good point there. A lot of these laws were made before, concepts like streaming were something that you know, we used every day. You know, streaming is the main way I listen to music on the computer nowadays. I think it'll be, it needs to find the right balance, because if it costs too much, then, you know, even the big successful streaming businesses are going to find it hard to stick it out, you know, if they're having to pay too much. If it's too low, then, you know, I think it, a lot of people would say competition is good, but if there's too, if the barrier to entry is too low and we've got too many streaming services, you know, in a way, I almost just wish that one company would win out, whoever it is, because then it's like, okay, that's, you know, that's the way music's going to be for now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm still not sure actually, you know, which way it's going to end up going.
No, I mean, and there's two sides here, because on the one side we have the fairness, the Internet Radio Fairness Act that's going through. On the other side, we have the Interim First Act that nobody is really talking about. I found a couple of references on a Variety article, but I hadn't seen any major references to it before. And this is actually being proposed. It's an opposing bill to the first one, and which has been proposed by A2IM and SAG-AFTRA and the RIAA, which basically reverses the proposition of the Internet Radio Fairness Act. So this second bill, the Interim First Act, would actually lobby to raise the rates of Sirius XM to bring them closer to the rates of Pandora, rather than lowering the rates of Pandora to bring them closer to the rates of Sirius XM. So that's a really interesting take, because you can see that there's a push and pull. So the music industry is really pushing so that this reduction doesn't happen, and would actually like to see an increase on what Sirius XM has to pay, because they're making big profits right now. And really, like, the key is in the balance at this point, because, you know, we can't lower the rates too much, but we can't raise them too much, because they both carry their own set of problems, you know, whichever one ends up happening. So do you reckon, Gerd, that these two opposing acts might help us achieve a relative balance in the outcome? Or do you think it's going to go one way or another in a fairly polarized manner?
I think this conversation about the streaming rates is a rather ridiculous angle, because, as I said before, you know, the real thing that's happening here is that, you know, what would really be fair if you have the 2 billion users in the world that are connected to the internet,
yeah,
if there was a way for them to pay something like $10 a year, you know, for access to streaming and downloading music, that would raise $20 billion, right? I mean, that would be fair to the artists, it'd be fair to the users, it'd be fair to the tech companies, and then after you get that, you can buy other 50 things like live concerts or HD,
yeah.
You can create all the upselling, right? I mean, talking about fair, you know, Spotify isn't being treated fairly, right? Because they can't actually offer what people want. At the same time, all the artists are complaining there isn't enough money. I mean, it's like a chicken and the egg. This is a completely, the music ecosystem is completely dysfunctional. I mean, it's this idea, yeah. It's just, they're all battling over stuff that the consumer isn't interested in. You know, this is like, you know, the consumer is willing to pay. We see that with Netflix. We see it with many other things, right? And here there are companies arguing about stuff that was okay 15 years ago was an issue, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in 5 years, we're going to have 5 billion people connected to the mobile internet. And we're not going to be able to get money out of them if we argue about stuff that was relevant 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I think you raise an interesting scenario that if you know, all the music listeners or, you know, computer users were to pay an annual subscription rate, could be very low and it would raise a huge amount of money. But although that is, you know, that would be an absolute dream, is that something that could ever happen? Which company could possibly in the situation to do that? And, you know, I think people would be happy to pay even more than the $10 or $20 you propose per year, certainly if it was, you know, for media beyond just music. But you know, sadly, I can't picture something that good happening because, yeah. You know, there's, you know, before it could happen, then there's a whole battle over, you know, negotiating how that's divided between companies. But if that could be solved, then that would be... that would be amazing for consumers, absolutely.
Look, I mean, the music industry is killing the golden goose at every chance they get, right? Whether it's Groove Shark, whether it's Spotify, whether it's RDO, they're charging a lot of royalties so that the companies have to go and figure out how they can make enough money and make it full of ads or charge $10 a month. instead of saying, let's make it so low that we can get 100% of the online population to participate, like, you know, the premium models that already exist in different places, and then we upsell them to the next product, right? They're reversing it and say, you have to pay to play, like the New York Times paywall, right? I mean, who's going to pay $300 a year to read the New York Times? A million people, right? I mean, that's not successful. Successful would be to say, you know what? You can read the New York Times for $30 a year, and then there's another five things you can buy once you're inside, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is how you get people to convert, you know? So to me, this whole debate is symptomatic of the stuff that's really broken.
Yeah.
The rights holders are pointing to the tech companies and saying, you should be paying more. The tech companies are pointing to the consumers saying, you should be paying more, right?
Yeah.
But really what is required, nobody wants to do because they don't have the balls.
But, and also there's a symptomatic problem with the music industry, which is structural in the sense that I don't think there's any other industry that is so complex in terms of how the rights are divided and how the royalties are collected by different organizations, both at a national and international level. So whilst the New York Times could feasibly, you know, say, you know, we're going to set this rate, a low rate, and we're going to do all sorts of upsells, and they don't have any problems in terms of, you know, the content syndication. They don't have to, you know, all the rights to the articles are theirs. So they don't have to worry about that side. And the music industry is just so incredibly complex to find an agreement between all the hundreds of different organizations that are involved. So, so do you reckon there's any feasible way that that's going to be solved in the short term?
Yeah, death.
Yeah.
You know, basically death. You know, I mean, this is just basically, they've been saying this for 20 years. The rights societies, the publishers, and the artists and the managers can't agree. Well, then they're going to die if they can't agree, right? I mean, either you're going to figure out a way forward or you're just not going to be there. I mean, look at the stuff that is working, like The Economist or The Atlantic or, you know, other models like this that are working just fine, right? It's not the consumer's fault and it's not the artist's fault, right? It's the middleman that have to get that button gear.
You ask, can it be solved in the short term? Although, you know, logically you could say anything could be solved. Realistically, I don't see a solution coming out in the near term. I think part of the problem is that the music industry is actually quite an old business. You know, it's still built on the foundations of companies that would sell sheet music years ago. If it wasn't for that, then you know that's the sheet music industry, you know, really was the publishing industry. If music as a business was set up today, it wouldn't have these complicated facets, and it would be a lot easier to organize and to, you know, improve on in the future. I think another problem is that it's kind of comparable to the banking sector a few years ago, or even today perhaps, where, you know, at the end of the day, these labels and companies, they are run by people, and ultimately these people might not plan to be there for the long term. The goal is for some people to earn profits in the short term, and that lends itself to, you know, pushing for things like, hey, we want higher royalty rates right now, rather than, okay, let's take the long-term view. What could we do to make this really work and ensure a future for, you know, the next decade and beyond?
Yep.
But, you know, it's a cultural issue, really. And can the culture of people who work in these companies be changed? I'm not saying that it's all wrong, but I think it's really bound by the structure that it's all been built on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the music companies are distribution companies, right? By and large, the top ones, okay? And because they are distribution companies, they don't want another distribution model to be prevalent, you know, like Pandora or Spotify is offering. Because if they do this, then the current scheme of distribution, which is by and large still CDs, right, and single-track downloads, that will be changed forever, which they don't like, not because it doesn't make money, but because they can't control what happens in the system, right? If there's a flat rate distribution system, everybody does what they want, they can't control where the money goes, right? And this is exactly like the oil companies, right? We know it's better not to use oil to drive a car, but are we ever going to get there? Because, you know, the 1% of the companies worldwide that are in the oil business, they make the money, right?
Yeah.
This will not change until there's public intervention. And instead of the U.S. courts looking at this and saying, you know, they should pay more, they should just solve the damn problem for everyone, not just put a tiny Band-Aid on. I mean, you know, my view is that if Pandora and all the other guys could just pay a percentage of their revenues, you know, for the streaming, but then they could also have a bundle that you can buy for the downloading,
yeah,
that would be that would be tucked into an ISP subscription or a mobile phone subscription, so that you can get the ISPs to contribute to this, right? I mean, think about this for a second. If you went to AT&T, Verizon, or T-Mobile, or Vodafone, or Telefonica, and you said $10 a year will get the access to the entire music catalog to give to your customers, these guys would pay the $10. They wouldn't even charge the customers, right? Because, you know, they spent $350 on acquiring a customer, right?
Yeah.
They're going to spend $10 on bundling that into and basically reducing their churn rate, and that would be a piece of cake, right? I mean, but that's not being done because it would shift the balance of power away from these old guys. You know, they don't even read their own email. This, I'm sorry, I get upset about this because it's been a topic for 12 years, you know.
Well, one question I'd ask is what could shift those bounds of power, as you say? You say potentially, you know, it would have to be a call from the people to make this sort of thing happen. But what could rally people together like that? Do consumers ultimately, give it that much thought? And in turn, does that mean there will be voices, you know, from the public to that try and, you know, push for these kind of changes?
Well, people are already doing this. I mean, people are not buying, basically, right? I mean, iTunes is declining or flat in almost all countries. And iTunes is really great, but I'm going to spend $10,000 on songs. If I want 10,000 songs, you know, it's not going to happen, right? So it's declining everywhere. And even though I love Apple stuff, you know, this is a trap, right? And it's not going anywhere, right? So people aren't buying. The second thing is that the telcos and operators around the world, you know, it's a $3.5 trillion business, right? The mobile operators, you know, $350 million a day in SMS. So these companies are all saying, you know what, we're going to wait until these fools come, and then we'll pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
Right? Because financially speaking, it's chicken feed, right? And this is all to the detriment of the artist, who's just sitting there and say, I wish I would get a better contract for my label, you know, like, as it was 20 years ago, and to the detriment of the user that's being sued because they're using BitTorrent, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think three things has to happen. First, consumers stop buying stuff that doesn't really work, okay? And they are stopping to buy CDs, of course. Second is when you have government saying, you know what, this is really a dysfunctional ecosystem. It's just a mess. You know, we have to figure out, as here in Brazil, the government is investigating whether there should be compulsory license for this, right? For digital music. And we're considering this in Switzerland, by the way. There's a big debate about this right now, to solve this problem by creating a license, like just like the pharma companies in Brazil were forced to license, you know, the pharma for the Brazilians who didn't have money.
Right? Yeah.
So there are a lot of parallels there, and I think in a dysfunctional system, the market will not clear this up because the market is stuck with the oil companies, i.e. the major labels. You know, they have no reason to change this because they control all the pieces of it.
Yeah. And I mean, one instance that epitomizes sort of the problems that are faced by any company that works in this space, from a small company to a very large company like Pandora, is Pandora itself and all the issues that it's facing in the last couple of months. On the one side, it's facing problems with the bill they're trying to pass to try and lower the royalty rates. Whether the amount, as we discussed, the amount by which these royalty rates should be lowered is of course up for discussion. But that's another matter. On the other side, they are having real troubles with ASCAP to try and get the license fee set. So they had to sue ASCAP. In order to mandate a New York court to set fees because they haven't managed to reach an agreement with them. On the other side, there's issues of stock, because of course a lot of people are looking into the company right now, and people are, you know, have I think it was Digital Music News that found out that by looking at the various transactions on the stock of Pandora, that the executives of the company sold about $62 million worth of stock in the last year. So that comes to makes people think, oh, is that a normal amount of transactions, or are the executives not quite so certain that the company is going to continue succeeding in the short term, so they cashed out some of their options in order to have some security. So there's all these problems.
Can you blame them?
Sorry? No, exactly.
Can you blame them for doing that? I mean, there is no security whatsoever in music licensing, right? I mean,
exactly.
They'll do whatever they want, right? Because basically there is no law that says that Pandora is entitled to this. you know, everybody knows that Pandora is essentially a substitute for iTunes and a cheap or free substitute for iTunes. Okay. Yeah. That's how people are using it. So my view is that either you legalize that and give it to them all the way so that they can actually make build a real business, or you throttle them and then you eventually kill them, right?
Yeah, and the last point that
this is the bad thing about Pandora. There's no way for them to control that.
Yeah, and the last point is that aside from all the things that I've already listed, there's also the huge question of mark of competition, because of course Pandora now is fairly, you know, sitting by itself fairly happily in the States as far as the type of service that they offer. But if Apple was to come in with a very similar type of service that can compete with them, then that's another factor that could destabilize the profits and the growth of the company in the long term. So there's so much stuff going on for them. And you know, it's just one company trying to work in this space. And as much as, you know, there could be things that are wrong with it, or, you know, I'm not saying that they are, you know, angels or anything like that. I'm just saying that for any company that's trying to work in the digital music industry right now, wherever they are, they face huge challenges on all sorts of different fronts that are very hard to overcome, basically.
I think one comment on the Pandora staff, you know, cashing out a bit of their stocks. I mean, obviously it's worth that kind of thing being investigated. And yeah, it could potentially suggest that they think, okay, we need to do this now before it's, you know, not worth as much. But at the same time, I think, you know, if they're going to have their IPO, and then, you know, if you were at this company and you'd think, well, here's an opportunity to literally just become a multimillionaire, you know, I don't think it would be, it's not that unusual.
No, exactly.
I can't say that statistically, but, you know, it's not really surprising that people did cash out a bunch of money. So, you know, we'll find out if people keep looking into it. You know, maybe they'll find that actually, you know, there's other incentives for cashing out like that. But, you know, it's really no surprise on the other hand either.
Yeah, I mean, and it's only a story because we're talking about the music space, really, to be honest. I mean, in any other startup that... Oh, sorry, Tama, I was still talking. I couldn't hear you.
No, no.
Okay, cool. In any other startup, you know, in a different field, this type of cashing out is not actually a huge amount of money because the company is actually worth a lot more, and it probably wouldn't be scrutinized as much. But because we're talking about a music company, because we're talking about the fact that they are, you know, giving part of their, you know, the profits to you know, of their income to artists, everything that happens within that kind of environment is scrutinized quite a bit more than it would in a different ecosystem. At least that's how it feels like when we look at some of the articles that are sort of accusing them of doing this, and you don't know whether that's something that is normal practice or whether that's indeed out of some sort of fear. But in any case, we're not talking about huge amounts. It's kind of relatively reasonable for executives of that type.
That's actually one of the interesting things about music companies these days, is that really the big music companies are tech companies. You know, you'll see companies like Pandora, you know, at the top of the tech meme chart. Tech meme's the you know, chart of pop trending technology stories, and you know, similarly, big music companies are the players like Google and Apple now. And you know, that sort of thing wasn't a feature at all a decade ago, or you know, at least a little over that. So yeah, it's interesting how those lines have massively blurred. You know, tech and music goes hand in hand more than ever. You know, they've obviously got a, you know, history together, but you know, now it's you know, they walk on the same path completely.
Let me comment real quick on Apple, okay?
Sure.
It's very interesting to see. Now, again, I'm an Apple fanboy in terms of using their stuff, right? But Apple is doing exactly the same that the telecoms will be doing, right? Because Apple is basically saying, you know what, we don't give a damn how much we lose or make with music. It's not material to us. I think it's less than 3% of their revenues, right? And apps are more than music even, right? So if they have streaming music, they could subsidize every user probably to the tune of $30 a year. Wouldn't matter, because we're all happily buying the hardware, right?
Yeah.
And they use music and movies and books as a crutch of accelerating hardware sales. And so the other guys, the telcos and the operators, they would be very happy to do the same, except that their margin isn't so big. They're not as dominant, right? And they're not as daring in terms of, you know, they don't have the power with the music people, right?
Yeah.
So for the music industry, the winning model is to bundle the music into any kind of offering, whether it's hardware or mobile operators or ISPs, and create a floor where everybody creates money, And also, of course, also causes advertising, you know, which is a big funding mechanism in the future, right? And then go from there and say, you know what, now that you're basically covered with music, now you can buy HD versions, you can buy concert tickets, you can buy webcasts, you can buy fan clubs, you can buy apps. You know, that's the key, right? And music companies are not realizing this is what's going to happen anyway, regardless of what they have in mind, right? Because that's what consumers want.
Yeah, and talking about you know, subsidization and eating the cost of music in some way, I wanted to introduce one of the other stories that I wanted to talk about, which is the fact that Google introduced as part of their announcement last week, which is kind of like went fairly unnoticed, but they introduced their own Google Match service for the Google Play Store for music. So it's basically a similar service to what Apple is offering. But the interesting thing is that while Apple decided to charge for that service, I think it's not much. It's only $25 a year, I think, or something like that in the US. Google is going to do that for free for up to 2,000 tracks, I think. So that's a really interesting thing because, as you mentioned, you know, eating the cost of some of that music accessibility is a key part of what's going to happen in the future. But Apple was not prepared to do that. Was not prepared to lose the money. And wanted to make some money out of that, whilst Google is just going to try out and see what happens by giving it away for free. So do you think that's going to give them a leg up in the competition and what's going on, what's going to happen, you know, on the user level? Because, of course, Android now has got 75% of the marketplace on smartphones. So if Google offers a service for free, that could be a hugely important milestone for them.
I'm surprised they've done it for free, but you know, it is massively attractive. I use iTunes Match. I've never managed to have it upload the last of my songs. I know it matches most of them, but you know, anything that isn't on the iTunes store, obviously, it will try and upload those versions. And despite having iTunes open plenty, can't seem to upload the rest of it. You know, obviously last year Google tried this online locker thing where people could upload the whole collections, and I don't know anyone who didn't say, well, who tried it, who didn't say it didn't take forever, or they didn't just give up on it. So, you know, it's sensible that Google's, you know, at least trying to do this. And if they've got the most smartphones, I mean, if they're doing it for free, then crikey, they're going to, you know, they could really lock people into that little system. You know, if I had an Android phone and it was free, it would be a complete no-brainer. And what will be interesting is to see how much they try to communicate that to those users. You know, is it something that they kind of put out there and they make it feasible, but it's actually kind of just speaking to the media and the very tech-savvy people who will, you know, spend most of their days checking out this media and therefore, you know, giving Google the positive PR? Or will they actually go the extra step and actually really push it to all those, as you say, I think 75% of, did you say 75% of smartphone users are Android, was that?
Yeah, it was a milestone announced this week, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, are they going to try and get all those people to, you know, match and then essentially, I guess, string for free, you know, from what could have been a completely pirated catalogue? And, you know, another thought is that, as far as I know, when you stream music from iTunes Match, it does actually pay some kind of publishing or royalty to the rights holder. What I don't know is what the deal is with Google there.
I would assume they
have
a similar
deal. Does that mean Google just saying, okay, we'll pay that cost, or are they somehow managing to evade that? Or and it'll be interesting to see, you know, if they do push it to all those Android users, and if it lasts, because maybe it would just be just too expensive to maintain. Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the business back to the same question. If you see what Google is doing, this is quite interesting, but it's really sort of it's a band-aid. It's kind of meaningless. It doesn't really, what's happening here is that, you know, we're in this shift away from ownership to access of music, right? So we're not necessarily going to pay to own the music. We can just click somewhere and it plays, and then maybe we'll click again. There's a bit of an upselling to have it play better or quicker or whatever, right? But we're moving to access. And if music becomes a product that's based as a service and as access, that's fantastic news for everyone because it's so much cheaper to distribute, right?
Yeah.
So if Google could get a license to put music into the network, you know, streaming and downloading also through YouTube, which everybody's using anyway, right? if that license was legalized in some neighborhood of, you know, $10-$20 a year, whatever you could afford there, right, would they take the license? I think they would, right? Because you know what's happening on YouTube. You know, YouTube is quickly becoming the first global TV player, you know, global broadcaster, and they're already commissioning movies, right? So imagine if this whole thing that people are doing with Download Helper and all the plugins, you know, where they're downloading MP3s, if that was legal, how much more could YouTube make? I think YouTube is going to make $2 or $3 billion a month in advertising when the video market is more mature, like say 3 years, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's a lot more than the entire music industry makes globally. I mean, so there's money there, and the music industry was smart. They would say, you know what, let's make a bundle out of this. But, you know, instead they prefer to go to court and sue them left and right and talk about nitpicky stuff that nobody is really interested in.
Yeah.
Well, if that were the solution, it would ultimately rely on the labels, you know, banding together and saying, right, we're going to decide on this as a group, rather than essentially, you know, compete with them, each other on that level as well. So
that's what happened with radio, right? Radio has a public license.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a collective license. It's not a change of copyright. It's a license, just like radio or television is licensed. You know, you don't have to ask the labels to play them on radio. They're not opposing to that. And they did oppose to that because it was free. Right? So it's exactly the same scenario. So you have all this this substitution wars with the like of Pandora and others, you know. That's not the real topic. The real topic is what happens, you know, when this becomes distributed music, as it is, you know, officially acknowledged. What do we do then? How do we make money? And how do we solve this problem? And how do we upsell from there, right? I mean, this is, and, you know, publishing versus recording, all these distinctions are becoming kind of meaningless because everything that happens on the internet is a copy.
Yeah.
In fact, you make your point, you know, there needs to be a way to upsell. And I think that's one of the big questions that I don't see discussed often enough. If we were to say that, you know, the baseline product were the equivalent of an MP3 stream, you know, at the minute, the upselling would appear to be the right to own and, you know, have that digital file on your hard drive, even though essentially playing that is not really technically different to playing that off another hard drive that happens to be somewhere else. So absolutely. The question is, how do we start to upsell? And I think, you know, that's where the trend for HD, you know, high definition audio, you know, that's something that Apple, you know, I think ought to have done. Certainly a year ago, you know, it could have really separated itself from Spotify and the likes, the other streaming companies, by saying, okay, well, actually, look, we've got something that really compares with CD quality. And that's something that streaming companies couldn't do without making their overheads just go through the roof. And, you know, because it just costs significantly more for them to stream that HD audio. So I'm surprised Apple didn't do that kind of move. It would be interesting if Apple did, if it were to bring out this supposed streaming service of some kind, no one knows what form that would take if it were to launch. But you know, if it could use all this extra money it has to fund, you know, what people would put in inverted commas, HD audio, then that's, you know, I think that's the way to... for companies to start upselling, if you like. But, you know, the question remains open. Are there other ways to upsell? And what are they? And who is in a position to do that? So that's the kind of thing I think ought to be, you know, on the discussion table a bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a dozen ways of upselling, right? You should read Kevin Kelly. He has this thing called New Generatives, where he's talking about the new ways of how money is being made in a digital realm. And for example, last week, Crosby, Stills & Nash launched an iPad app, right? And all the stuff that's on there, I can watch on YouTube, or I can stream somewhere for free. I can see all that stuff. But the iPad app is a really great way of bundling $30 a year. If you're a fan, you're going to buy this iPad app, right? But it's exactly the same content than anywhere else, really. It's just kind of repackaged, right? So I'm paying for the packaging, right? And that is a way of upselling. Or live concert recordings is already a $300 million business in the U.S. Right? So take that, for example, and say if I go to a show from John Mayer, I've downloaded all the John Mayer stuff as part of my free subscription. you know, now I'm going to pay another $10 to be part of the download club, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's myriads of things here, right?
Yeah.
But this will not work if we come to a toll booth every single time, you know, and we torture people by having to constantly put coins in for stuff that they wish. We punish them for their interest.
Yeah.
Well, actually, if you give some really good examples there of extra products that, you know, fans of bands would be tempted by. So I guess the next question would be what could companies like Spotify find a way of, you know, could it offer some kind of marketplace for this additional content?
Yeah, sure.
It'd be interesting to see if on Spotify, okay, so you either pay the small subscription, right, or the free rate, and, you know, underneath the album, then why not offer other products? That would be a really interesting, and it's, as far as we can see now, quite an original, thing for these streaming apps to do. But you actually remind me of there's something I've been hearing about. One of the trends for next year looks like premium content streams. So if you can imagine a sort of feed like Twitter, but it were, I'm not sure exactly what I could say, if it were to offer premium content, so let's say X Factor, for example, were to be on a platform. There are several platforms like this in the works, as far as I understand. And X Factor could, for example, beam songs that are being performed on the show. It would beam links to it. Now, yeah, okay, they could do links to iTunes from Twitter, for example. But what if you could also buy footage, or any of the other similar, you know, or any other music related product on that content stream, and, you know, people could follow these accounts or brands just as they do with Twitter, but rather than having this kind of fire hose of, you know, brands but also friends or, you know, people you've just followed randomly, it would be a very concentrated premium stream. Mixing my words up a little there, but that's one of the trends for next year. It does appear to be, premium content streams. And in fact, I wonder if that's a space that Twitter will move towards, because they've kind of been so, you know, people are getting a little apathetic to the whole Twitter scene. And, you know, they've kind of done so little to impress their, you know, Twitter's done so little to impress its fans that it makes you wonder if they've got something really big up their sleeve, yeah, like this waiting. But we'll see, you know, and that sort of platform would be, you know, really useful for, giving additional content,
yeah,
products,
sure,
for these companies to sell.
Sure. And I think I'm going to bring up a story that might make Gerd angry again, because I've got the feeling that you don't like, you know, compartmentalizing content, because it doesn't make sense at this point to compartmentalize content in different streams, even though it's kind of the same thing, really. So the Vevo and YouTube story is interesting, because there had been rumors in the last couple of, like, 3 or 4 months that Vevo and YouTube were on a sort of a breaking point as far as their contracts were going, and that Vevo might decide to go its own way, because it had achieved so much in such a short space of time. Now, the latest story to come out of Seoul is that it was coming from John Hirai, who heads music for YouTube Japan and Korea, and deals with Vevo, and he said that basically the things that were written in the press were not basically true. He's been involved in the negotiations himself, and that YouTube and Vevo will continue to have a partnership for the next coming years. And that's interesting, because I mean, and the article goes on to say, it's an article by Paul Resnikoff, that in fact Vevo owes the majority of its streams to YouTube, and the majority of the plays that come into Vevo come from YouTube. So it's interesting to see that there's these two, you know, completely separate companies, but they are in this weird symbiotic relationship and can't really get away from each other, even though I'm sure Vevo would like to get away from YouTube. And it's kind of created this weird sort of two-tier video content, whereby Vevo is the high-quality premium content that gets higher ad ad revenue as well. I think per advert, it's a lot more expensive to advertise on Vivo than on YouTube. And YouTube is just the mainstream platform that supports that ecosystem to exist. So what's your thoughts on that, and Gerd? And do you think it, you know, there would be any way for Vivo to get away from YouTube?
First, I have to disclose, you know, YouTube and Google, as well as some of the labels and publishers, are my clients. Right?
Sure.
So I have lots of conversations with all kinds of people when I do my speeches and stuff, right? So, I mean, you can see the client list on my website at mediafuturist.com, but it includes most of those companies, including Samsung and Nokia and others. Right?
Sure.
You know, I think that basically the YouTube Vivo thing points again to this issue that it's sort of a dysfunctional system, right? The amount of discussions that we're having about this stuff that sounds like some sort of family therapy, right? That is just completely, I mean, the consumer doesn't care, you know, whether this is a dysfunctional family. I mean, nobody cares what your family problems are when you're outside in your soccer club, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's basically, this is not of any interest to the consumers. Right? So what needs to be done is on a larger level is to solve the underlying problem, right? And the underlying problem is that there's a bunch of companies trying to play ping pong while the consumer is standing holding the back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pathetic. Right? I mean, if you look, the solution for that will only come from the tech companies, from the mobile companies, from the likes of Samsung, from Telefonica, from all these companies who are just going to say, you know what, we're going to disrupt this whole thing. Right? And that's what's going to happen in the next 3 to 5 years, right? All that stuff will be solved by outsiders, right? Whether with permission or not. I mean, YouTube didn't have permission. MySpace didn't have permission, right? Can Facebook be avoided? Now they got 1 billion users, right? So the disruption will come from those players, right? And Twitter, right? And yeah, they will have to go with it. I mean, people can't afford, you know, any country of the world, ask the labels or publishers or artists if they're happy with what YouTube is paying, and the answer is no. But can they do anything about it? The answer is no, because yeah, YouTube is the place to be. So, you know, I'd like to talk briefly about one thing, you know, which I think is very important, that Spotify is in the same spot than Pandora.
Yeah.
And on a different level. Right? Artists and labels are complaining the money isn't enough for Spotify. You know, at the same time, labels and the big independents like Merlin actually own 35% of Spotify, right? So they're all complaining that Spotify isn't enough money. At the same time, they will not allow Spotify to be bundled for premium or feels like free into the telcos, right? So they're complaining about the golden goose that they've already eaten, basically, right? And, you know, the solution would be for Spotify to be included in 2 billion mobile phone subscriptions for a feels-like free deal that is paid for by the ISPs, right? That would be the solution to the large-scale problem, right? If Spotify remains at 7 or 8 million users or even 10, they will die,
yeah,
right? Because there's no way that they can monetize enough to get to the same level than YouTube, which is free.
But Vivo is making a lot more money than YouTube right now, so that's an interesting company to look at least in terms of the advertising, because I mean they are giving away stuff for free, it's just that they're managing to monetize it better.
I think they have a better way of monetizing the advertising because it's cleaner and not as chaotic as YouTube, right? But YouTube is a much larger game, because basically what's happening here is that YouTube is finding those mechanisms of having non-interruptive advertising and engaging advertising, which they have to do, otherwise nobody will go there. I mean, we're talking about a global advertising budget of roughly $1 trillion,
yeah, right?
That includes advertising and marketing, public relations. And that's shifting towards video. So YouTube knows this huge watering can is coming, right? And all they need to do is have a large audience.
Yeah.
Right? And that's much better than what Vivo is doing, in my view, which is monetizing dollars and advertising. But do they have a large audience? None. Not really.
Right. Tom, your take on YouTube versus Vivo?
Well, I mean, I find it hard to see how Vivo could survive without YouTube. It could, I mean, it has its own standalone app, but does the average music fan, does Vivo have the brand power to be installed by all these music fans? You know, are people going to think I need to go and get the Vivo app? It's In a way, it's not in the same league as YouTube as far as awareness goes, even though it is the kind of, it appears to be the biggest, you know, music videos brand. But, you know, I could understand why Viva want to get out of that relationship. But I think the vast majority of its views come through YouTube. So, you know, how could it ever step away? It would have to have something pretty solid. And I can't personally imagine, you know, how it would do that.
Yeah.
Well, you take a parallel, you know, in this whole debate, take a parallel to Kindle, okay, to the Amazon Kindle. When Jeff Bezos came up with this, the publishers hated the idea. They didn't give him any discount, right? He subsidized it. Now he's selling more books on the Kindle. And you know where this is going, right? The Kindle will be free because very cheap to make, you know, the basic Kindle. And the books will be $3. But he's going to sell it to 2 billion people.
Right? Yeah.
That's clearly the path that they're going with this, right? And then they have their own people publishing directly through the Kindle, right? So the publishers who refuse any of that progress, they're going to be completely kicked out of this scenario as a lead provider, right? Because they're going to be just as at the mercy of this company who basically tried to work with them that they had rejected and that they had Amazon had supported with like $5 billion worth of subsidies or something like that to make it work. Right?
Yeah.
And we're exactly in the same position with music. If they go to Pandora and Google and YouTube and they keep asking for higher rates, right? They're timing it so they can get the higher rates and then exit.
Yeah.
And there is no ecosystem thinking here. That's not about the artist. It's not about copyright. It's not about the user. It's about corporations.
Right? Yeah.
And that is just not a good thing. I mean, this is against fair practice, in my view, completely. It's like the oil companies are not doing fair practice to the planet. That is clear to all of us, except for Obama, maybe.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
All right, well, I think we have time for just for one quick more story before we have to wrap up. And so from the various stories that I have here that we have to talk about, I think I'd just quickly mention the Facebook story. So basically, Facebook did a sort of a announcement slash, ran through a few talking points that concern music apps specifically on Facebook that are using the Facebook timeline and their new Open Graph technology, of course. So the figures are that Facebook revealed that its users, so this is from a Donatam article on CNET, that Facebook revealed it has played 62.6 million songs 22 billion times in the last 13 months amongst its users that are using Open Graph. And it also posted figures on some of the apps that have benefited from this graph, which include 8-track, Songza, Soundtracking, band page, and also more localized apps like the India-based mobile and desktop app Savn. So it's a really interesting thing that Facebook decided to really target developers of music apps, because of course it's not a huge money maker right now, but it's definitely a huge engagement maker for them, and they really need that. And also I think it was an interesting thing that they wanted to really try and take away the stigma that the timeline has killed engagement a little bit on Facebook, that because that's the truth. And it's super interesting that they've actually included Bandpage as part of their list of apps, because they've really been hammered by the new timeline, because the fact that they can't have the tab as featured has reduced their user base extensively over the last few months. So what's your take on this announcement? I mean, more than the figures itself, I'm interested in what you think might be Facebook's state of mind in regards to both its timeline and the relationship with the developers that might have deteriorated a little bit given everything that's happened in the last few months and the timeline and how that has affected the engagement of users on the platform. Who wants to take it?
I'll take a quick stab. You know, I think personally Facebook is absolutely clueless as far as their music strategy is concerned. It's kind of despicable, actually. I have no idea what they're trying to do here. And clearly they'd have a lot of power with a billion users to really change the game, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know what they're doing here. I have no idea really how they intend to solve this issue, but they certainly could. So I think they're struggling on many issues. The top issue that Facebook certainly has is reinventing advertising to be acceptable to Facebook users. I think they're putting all the energy into that direction by saying, you know, how we're going to make Facebook palatable for people for an advertising mechanism, because, you know, they want to make $2 billion a month, just like Google. And that's the goal, right? Music is like, I don't know. But it's a big mistake, in my view, not to engage with music in a better way.
Yeah, I think I completely agree that Facebook doesn't seem to really have a solid music strategy because it's kind of chopped and changed its tactics a little along the way. Also, it's partly because it doesn't seem to have a really solid strategy, for its wider business, other than just focus on advertising. Obviously, that doesn't necessarily lend itself to, a really solid music economy. One example of how it's, had to change tact is, abandoning HTML5. It said it bet too much on HTML5. I think the plan would have been that it felt like it could have had the HTML5 app store. We know HTML5 is a technology, and I know it's a bit of a buzzword, but just to use that word to bundle that kind of web technology together, I think it thought it would be the web wide app store, and it turns out its HTML5 apps kind of didn't take off in the way it perhaps expected, and then it's also gone native with its mobile apps after thinking, yeah, well, HTML5 can do everything native apps can do, and it turns out actually it kind of isn't working that way, and device manufacturers like Apple don't necessarily have an interest in making their browser or the Safari powerful enough, because then it would actually compete with its native app store. But that's I digress. It's music apps. I think you say it's interesting that they include Bandpage, but actually, I see Bandpage more often than any other app because so many bands will treat their Facebook page as their home page, and in turn, they will often think. In turn, one of the best known ways of putting your songs on Facebook is to use an app like Bandpage. I'm not actually aware of any others. I'm sure there will be some. So yeah, I'm really not surprised that a lot of people are using apps like Bandpage. I'm not familiar with the others. I don't actually use them. The closest I come to using music through Facebook is clicking the list. And now, which afford me to Spotify, but for a lot of people, it still does act as a homepage, and Facebook is going to be important for as long as people feel like it's a kind of a standard way to communicate with people. But we've all seen how fallible tech companies can be. Even Facebook a year ago seemed indestructible, and over the last year, it's like had so many dents in its armor that we can lose count. But ultimately doesn't appear to have a solid music strategy, but it
No.
does, at least have its foot in the door, so it's not like it's not a player.
No, that's fair. It's kind of
But is it going to change the world with music? I don't know. I
no.
don't
It's
think so.
hilarious though that to see like both Google and Facebook, that are two of the biggest tech companies in the world, they both have sort of botched their music strategy and are really trying to catch up at this point.
Yeah, but if you talk to them, what they're saying is saying the music guys are the absolute worst people in the world to talk to, and this is why this is the problem, right? Because they think you give them gold, they think it's garbage. You give them garbage, they think it's gold. It's just unbelievable, right? And the only ones that have succeeded is Apple, because Steve Jobs said to them, "You know what? You can have all the money you want, right? I'll create a fake economy for you, and it's protected." Right? It's just. This is pathetic. I mean, let me say a final thing because I have to go pretty soon.
Sure.
A final thing about Pandora and stuff, right? Rather than going to Pandora and the other guys and saying you have to pay more, they should give a global license to Pandora to roll out the service, right? That would allow Pandora to make a lot more money with advertising and bundling and freemium, and put them closer to Spotify, or even merge the two and create a global license scenario that allows them to prosper and be ubiquitous.
Yeah.
The only way these guys will make money if they're absolutely ubiquitous and everywhere, and people can contribute to the money flow in all different ways. This is the only way forward, rather than stifling them even further and killing them eventually, which they're certainly going to do with Spotify, probably also with Pandora. And there needs to be a conclusion on this, right? I mean, it's again, as I said, it's dysfunctional, not just on the micro level, but on the top level, right? And that is the real problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, guys, for coming on. Can I just finish briefly by asking you if you have anything you want to plug, or either your website or anything that you've done, or your Twitter account for the end of the show? So, Tom.
Well, my Twitter is my name, which is Tom Davenport. Website is tomdavenport.co.uk. But I think one thing to recommend from this week, because I remember you mentioned it's worth sharing anything from the week that we particularly
Sure.
liked, the Calvin Harris app,
Oh,
which
cool.
I think has the most original DRM, if you like, ever, where it plays the album for free, but only if you dance, which I think is the best barrier to entry I've ever heard of. And obviously, you know, a good little incentive for people to, you know, just buy it, because then they can sit down and enjoy it as well. So I thought that was the most interesting thing I think I've seen this week. And, you know, I think the people who made that are now speaking to dance labels, so I can picture the same format, the same kind of app being used for a sort of an entire dance label where it could stream its entire catalog if you dance, and if you like stuff, you could favorite it for later. So I think that's an idea that we might see a little bit more of, or I'd like to see more of it.
Okay, so and just to finish off, Gerd, anything you wanna plug for this week?
Yes, well, I think my recent book would be a good read for everyone. It's called The Future of Content.
Yeah, I've got that. It's great.
And if you want it for free, you can just Twitter me at gleonhardt, G-L-E-O-N-H-R-D. You can find it on Amazon Kindle. I think it's $3. You know, I tried to make it free, but they wouldn't let me.
Yeah.
But it's quite good. And if you want to get all my other books for free, I have four other books. One is Music 2.0. You just Google GERD, like the disease, you know, GERD, gastrointestinal reflux disease. So just Google that and free PDF.
Oh, great.
And then you find all my books. So just Google GERD and free PDF, and then you'll find. Or just tweet me at Twitter, okay?
That's great. That's a great offer. I think you know, the listeners should really follow that and go and get the books, because I know I read The Future of Music a fair few years ago, and it was a great read.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's a good life now.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thanks so much, guys. It was great having you on. Have a great day, and enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks so much.
Okay. See you down the road.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Looking for music.